just had a really good question, and I think that it's something that we've addressed before, but Anne, do you want to repeat your question?
Sure. Hi, Sean. I was just talking about, I read an article this morning about a woman, a white woman, who decided not to publish her book. It was on the verge of publication because it is about a culture of predominantly Black people historically in the South. And I just have been thinking about the topic a lot because I've written about, in the past, I've written about characters of different ethnicities, different races, and I know it's really a sensitive topic right now, but I was also just like grieving for this person who spent 5 years writing a book, or however long, we don't know how long. But I was just wondering if there was a way we could open some conversation in the community about this topic, because I also don't want to be reactionary and be like, I should be able to write about whatever I want, you know. I want, and anyway, that's it. That's just the top. I just bring it up as like a, something was on my mind this morning and
sure,
grappling with.
Yeah, it's on everybody's mind right now. And I think it's a good thing. Okay, so the way I approach contemporary life, I have a joke with my kids and with my wife, because my wife and I are, I'm like the last year of baby boomer, 1964, and my wife is Gen X. So we kind of have this joke that's actually, as all jokes are, it's funny because it's true. And so in the past couple of years, we've been saying things to each other like, I think I was the one who came up with this, where I said, I've reached my expiration date. And what I meant by that is that the means by which I have framed my life and my world are locked into a context, a historical context, that for good reason is being fragmented and reconfigured. So this is the generation gap writ large. And there's so many second order effects of the pandemic that we're now starting to see rise and experience. And they're all bringing things that have been subconsciously underneath the surface of everyday cultural movement, that it's rather shocking. Because we all intuitively have seen these patterns in our lives that are nonsensical. So, you know, to answer the question about whether or not we have the like what our responsibilities are as storytellers, I would go back to essentially the global abstract understanding of storytelling. And I hold on to that dearly because I believe it's an evolutionary, empirically adaptive advantage for our species. And so what I mean by that is that storytelling, in my estimation, and I think there's very compelling empirical evidence about this, that storytelling is the means by which our species has become quote unquote godlike on the planet. So what storytelling is the ability to understand past, present, and future as a progressive movement through time. And on top of that, evolved sort of through the Axial Age in the West, and in the rise of Lao Tzu and Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha. So it's cross-cultural. That's all I'm saying, is that I'm not saying this only came out of what we consider Western civilization with the rise of Socratic thinking. I'm saying this has happened in multiple cultures over multiple periods of time, and probably there are extinct civilizations where it emerged from there as well. So second order thinking is just essentially thinking about the way we think. And the axial age is this notion of, well, if we have the capability of thinking about the way we think, and we have the capability of creating these abstract expressions of species relatable values like the gods, that's interesting. And what does that mean? So we all, 99.99% of us, we share the same shit, you know? So now I'm not saying the differences aren't extraordinarily important too, but I think there's a yin yang here, right? So if we accept the notion, and I think most people with a firm grounding in reason and enlightenment, scientific method kind of thinking, which again is not one culture, it's multiple cultures evolving simultaneously. So this is something that emerges no matter where the evolutionary sort of niche is, right? So it arised in Mesopotamia, it arised in the Aztec culture, it arised in Western civilization, it arised in China, blah, 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 blah. So if we all believe that we share 99.9%, let's call it our genetic code, and that we differ by 0.01% of our base pairs, then I think it's reasonable to assume that there's something called universal human values, right? And what the universal human values are these things that we all agree upon, right? And there are basically five of them. I'll try and remember them. The one is sort of this, the Hippocratic oath, like first do no harm. So we all believe in the necessity of not harming one another. We value the fact that it's not cool to hurt somebody else. Everyone believes that, right? At their core, they come to, is it better to hurt somebody or not? Everybody falls on the, nah, it's better not to hurt somebody else. So that's the caring component of a universal human value. The second one is justice, fair play. We all agree, hey, it's not cool to rig a game. We all need equal opportunities to pursue our primary concern. We all deserve an equal, we all get to start at the same place on the frontier to pursuit of our ultimate vocation. So justice. The third one would be, group loyalty. Now, group loyalty is crucial evolutionarily because there used to be the notion of scarcity. So when we were all hunter-gatherers, we would sort of collect in groups of about 150 people in a tribe, right? So this tribe was like our peeps, right? And so cognitively, our brains, I think it's called the Dunbar number. Our brains can basically manage about 150 relationships and say, oh yeah, that's Betty from down the street, and Betty's kids are Abigail and Jim. And if Abigail and Jim need a glass of water because they're playing in my yard out front and they knock on my door, oh, it's Abigail and Jim, Betty's kids, therefore here's your water. I can keep all that in track, right? So we've got about 150 people that's our tribe. Now, in contemporary society, we have multiple tribes that we belong to. So adherence and loyalty to the tribe, not to soil our environment, in our tribal situation, is a universal human value, right? It only makes sense. Like, I don't want to, when my kids last night, they were playing the music extraordinarily loud in my backyard. And I came outside and I said, hey, turn down the music. We have neighbors who might not enjoy your music. So you can listen to it. They're cool with hearing it as background noise, but they don't want it invading their life. Okay, so we've got tribal loyalty. Really important, right? Because in the olden days, there was scarcity of resources. And so the way we would sort of figure out who's who is that I would wear a black shirt and all of my other people would wear black shirts. And so when we, this is the same, you know, the Crips and the Bloods, man, this is like serious stuff. So we identify the other, the stranger, as out of our tribal affiliation. So that's a universal human value. We want to keep our 150 peeps in our mind as on a hierarchical plane, as, you know, if push comes to shove, I'm going to give water to Abigail and Jim, who, because I know Betty down the street, rather than someone, if I only have a little bit of water, somebody I don't know. Okay, so that's, if we're going on like a hierarchy of universal human values, I'm sort of going down it, right? So what's the next one after that? We've got care, justice, tribal loyalty, authority is the next one. So the authority is, well, I need to play along with the authority figure in order to make sure the civilization works. So in my tribe, there's an authority figure or council that is sort of setting the tone and constraining our environment such that it's working, right? So I want to make shit continue to work. So I need to trust the authority figure. And so I value the authority figure's wisdom, right? So the authority figure, there's two hierarchies in which authority and power are attained. One is through just pure power. I'm stronger than everybody else. And then there's the prestige element, which is the growth hierarchy, right? So ideally, we attain power through prestige. And then when someone, it's like a council of elders. Years ago, I did a great book about a guy named Geronimo Pratt, who was a Black Panther who was thrown into prison for his life because of COINTELPRO, FBI, right? And I worked with Johnny Cochran and a couple of other people on the project. And he talked about in his community when he was a boy, he needed to go to the Council of Elders in his community before he could really figure out what to do with his life. So this Council of Elders, he became a Green Beret in Vietnam, right? And before he joined the armed forces, he went to the council and he said, hey, here's what I'm thinking. And they're like, well, let's think about it for a minute and then we'll get back to you, right? So this trusting of authority is important, right? So that's like number four on the hierarchy. And the last one is, it gets kind of tricky. But because we're in a pandemic, I now understand why it's so important. And it's called purity. And the purity universal human value is about making sure that people are abiding by our civilization's operating procedures. And purity became really important because of plagues. So you want to make sure, they're not wearing a mask. That gives me pause. Doesn't mean they're a bad person, but maybe I don't want to be around someone who isn't making the choice to wear a mask right now, right? That's a value consideration, that a judgment that each of us has to make today. So here we go. We've got our five major universal human values, and they all spin out into the values that we talk about in StoryGrid in terms of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, because we value what we need and we want to attain and hold up the values that satisfy our needs. All right, so what does all this have to do about whether or not a white person should publish a book or even consider writing a story about another culture? What it means is that we're all in this shit together, guys. You know, we really got to come down to it like that. And yes, our universal human values are not locked and loaded and perfectly maintained, and we've got to fix that. And we need to focus on caring, justice, the group, right? Our tribe. I'm assuming most people here are from North America, and right now there's a lot of controversy about bringing in foreign PhD students into our garden. And it's not a cut and dry, easy thing to talk about because it concerns tribe and patriotism and nation state. This stuff is difficult to justify today because we all belong to so many micro tribes that belonging to a macro tribe becomes very difficult to process. So I think we're at a sort of a place right now where our, at least my cognitive framework is being challenged, and I'm fragmented, and I'm having to rethink, and I'm having to reconsider, and I'm hitting all his lost moments, and I'm feeling myself falling into chaos, right? And you can look at that and go, holy shit, the world's falling apart. Or you can say to yourself, holy crap, isn't this where emergent practices emerge? Isn't the chaotic world the place in which novel things emerge? Wow. So instead of freaking out, I can grab hold of that and say, oh, wow, well, let me go back to my first principles and my universal human values and say to myself, is now a good time to be pressing my rights as a storyteller to describe my imaginal space of another person who is in a different tribe than I am? You know what? Maybe I could put a hold on that for now. Maybe today the context of that story wouldn't play very well. In fact, it might be even a little bit tone deaf to what's rising in the culture right now. So just as I, as a publisher, look at the marketplace and say, what genres are being oversaturated and what genres are not going to play right now, and make choices based upon that, whether or not the story works, whether or not I'll publish it, because I'm making probability analyses about what will successfully work in the marketplace, so should we think about whether or not it's the best time to be imagining somebody else's experience and writing a story about it through our imaginal storyteller lens. So I think everyone has a right, and not just a right, but it's really important to do it. So I tip my hat to everyone who's trying to put to take themselves out of their own worldview and framing and shift empathetically into another person's experience that we don't know very well. That's called empathy. That's called necessary bonding and understanding and care for everyone else in the community. So what I would advise is, hey, yeah, everybody's got the right. Everybody should consider the way the world is for other people. But in today's context, it's probably not a good idea to start throwing sparks into a very, you know, tender arena, and instead say, you know what, this work that I created is really important to me, but let me put it aside for a minute and consider what I got right, what I got wrong. Maybe I ask somebody, it's probably not, now's not the right time. I don't even think it's the right time to say, hey, you're a part of this other tribe I'm not a part of. Can you make sure that I haven't offended anyone? Because that's like a friend of mine just is dealing with that in such large measure right now that it's driving her crazy. Because she's like, I can't speak for my tribe. I'm just one individual in a micro group. How am I supposed to vet this for an entire population? That's impossible. So it's a paradox, right? We're living inside of a paradox, and that's good because life is a paradox. Life isn't one thing. There is no algorithm that's going to tell you whether or not to publish your book where you imagined a story set in another tribe that you don't know about. There's no algorithm, there's no answer to that other than, well, what's the rule of thumb? Well, let's go to our universal human values. Let's honor those five values in a way that makes sense to us. Do I care about other people? Absolutely. Do I want to hurt anybody? No. Cool. All right, number two, is it fair? Is it just for me to describe something that maybe I'm thematically and abstractly in tune with, but I don't know the particular specificity of right now? Is it just for me to do that? No, probably not. Not right now. Not right now. Back when Harper Lee published To Kill a Mockingbird, yeah. Because she was telling a story about two clashing, really interesting communities and the power structures inherent in them from the point of view of someone who's developing, who couldn't make sense of it because it didn't make any sense. That might be an interesting way to approach these kind of things. So I don't have a cut and dry answer, only to say we as storytellers, it's our responsibility to tell a shitload of stories and to keep thinking and to keep trying. So just because we've completed a work and it works and there might be a marketplace for it, we have to think about our universal human values and say, is it the right time to publish this book? You know what? It's not. I don't think it is. So I applaud that person who decided to say, you know, now's not a good time. Let me try something else, right? And it doesn't mean that you're giving in to blah, 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 and your rights are being, it doesn't mean that at all. What it means is that you're a thoughtful, empathetic, kind-hearted person who is not an egomaniac to the point where you're going to press forward just because it's your right. Now, we live still in a place where everyone has rights. So I'm not debating anybody's right to do something. What I'm saying is, how do we attune ourselves to the consensus reality right now? The consensus reality right now is this is a really, really complex issue that is not going to go away. It's not going to go away, nor should it go away. We can't push this underneath the surface any longer, which is great. So it's not going away. So let's live. Let's live in discomfort for a while. Let's be uncomfortable with each other. Let's think about what the fuck we say before we say something. Excuse my But it is that important, right? Let's think about it for a second. Now, what I love about this community is that all of this stuff that I'm talking about has been at the forefront of my mind. And I've been how am I as the quote unquote authority figure in this community going to respond to the consensus reality of today? And something inside of me kept saying, you can't fuck with your garden. You can't be the authority figure who tells people how to handle difficult situations. What you have to do is let it rise, emerge from the garden itself. And I have such great joy, because over the last couple of weeks, there's a couple of things have come up, and no one called me. No one said, hey, we've got this thing. We need the authority figure to tell us what to do. Instead, what happened was the people in the community talked together, and they figured it out. And they respectfully talked to one another from the bottom up. Hey, we're part of this deal. This is really important to all of us. Let's figure this out, because I'm confused. And this has happened a couple of times in a way that just makes me feel so good, because this is the opposite of a trap is a garden. And in a garden, you let things grow organically. A trap is when you lock someone in a prison and tell them, no, don't do that. No. Instead, the garden, one cell inside of the organism talks to another cell, and one cell says, hey, you can't put that garbage in my cytoplasm, right? And the other cell goes, holy shit, I'm sorry. I can't believe I just dumped my garbage in your cytoplasm. And then the other cell goes, hey, it's cool. Let's clean this shit up together. And then we can function together and we'll know each other better. And then we can act as a team and we can help other people if they start dumping garbage into the cytoplasm. And that's what happened. And that's evolution. That's a garden. It's not, the cytoplasm police screaming at everyone and keeping everybody afraid to even try to put anything into the cytoplasm. Anyway, I'm speaking abstractly, but I think that is what we're about in this tribe. This is about a garden, not a trap. There's no algorithms here. I don't have all the answers. I'm past my expiration date. I'm just trying to level up my cognitive capacities to align with this beautiful emergence of younger generations saying, you know what? This shit's enough, people. It's enough already. We all have to figure this out together. And whatever it's going to take to make people start thinking, that's what we're going to do. And that's the way I'm looking at all of the turmoil right now, is that it's a very thoughtful, and there are a lot of bad players in there too, right? With all good, it's not all good, it's not all bad, it's a little of everything. It's a yin and a yang. I'm not dismissing that there are Malachian players in this soup. But what I am saying is that let's chill and consider the context of where our consensus reality is today in the culture, and think about some stories that we could create. What kind of genres would be interesting that can sort of relieve people of this tension, but superimpose some heuristic solutions to opening up cognitive framing so that we can hold those five universal human values and put those in front put those in front so that everybody can go through that list before they scream and yell and throw Molotov cocktails. The end.
All right. We hadn't even gotten to a question on the list yet. We did have a question about the Q&As and how those are going to work after the sprints. We do have at least one monthly Q&A as a part of the guild already set in. So that will definitely keep happening. And I'm sure we'll continue to do some other things. So this question is from Dana. The general recommendation is that a body of work is classified in a single global genre. When analyzing, how do you treat projects that are a mixture of more than one global genre? Do you have any tips or advice concerning how we should view such books when they might be a masterwork?
Well, this isn't an easy question to answer because it's so well constructed. So I'm gonna try and answer it. I'm gonna have two answers. My first answer is a heuristic, meaning a rule of thumb that you should always just start with, right? And the rule of thumb is trust yourself when you're analyzing. So what might be like a couple of the editors have been working on the masterwork guide to the Harry Potter omnibus. And I've been getting questions from them saying, what do you think the global internal genre of Harry Potter is? And I have an idea, you know, but I think their idea is interesting no matter what my idea is. So the heuristic, the easy answer is, if you think the story, if somebody said, you've got to give me one genre, you've got to. What is it? One. You only get to pick one. And I insist that all storytellers have to come down on that line at some point. Then whatever it is that you say is the global genre, because you've thought through and you can back up your argument, that's the global genre for you. Now, the beauty of storytelling is that it's a subjective art. So the subjective art is such that it delineates universal human values through the prism of one specific cell. So the cell explains how it processes its energy in its mitochondria, its ribosomes, and all that stuff, if anyone's a biology nerd. And so that single cell can tell a story about, like the heart cell can tell a story that's different than the neuron in the brain, right? But together, the heart cell and the neuron cell make up the human being, which has its own story. So that's, if you want to look at it metaphorically, each one of us is like a cell in a multicellular organ system that creates a something that is much larger than the individual parts, which is a human being. If each one of us is a thematic cell in a multicellular tribal organism that makes up a system called Earth, then you can kind of see that. So when you're looking at a masterwork and you're not sure, is this a masterwork of worldview revelation or is it masterwork of thriller? Like, is Silence of the Lambs more thriller or worldview disillusionment plot? An argument can be made. This is the mother of all worldview disillusionment plots. And I would love to read that masterwork analysis guide saying that. So I'm gonna throw it back to you, all of you, the individual cells in this garden, the individual plants in this garden. Only you can make those determinations for yourself. But you can use the global tools of StoryGrid to help you figure it out for yourself. So when I'm looking at masterworks, like I'm finishing up The Hobbit. I finished The Wizard of Oz a little while, and this is all going to the stuff that I'm going to be doing on the heroic journey, or individuation as the Jungian term. And I do believe that there is a monomyth. I do believe that every story is one story. Every great masterwork story is of a kind. And I believe that kind is the monomythic representation of Jungian individuation that needs to be refreshed with a new language. And we need to sort of refresh the Campbell terminology because it's archaic. And the way to refresh that terminology is through the use of empirical cognitive science, which is the story grid method. So all stories that last, like what is it? The way I define a masterwork is something that lives beyond the life of its creator and is useful for succeeding generations after the creator has passed on to other pastures. It's immortality, right? So the creation lives on, the magnum opus in alchemical terms lives on beyond the creator of the thing itself. That's a masterwork. So that's how I describe it. And we have some masterworks in our, in multiple cultures, right? So some cultures' masterworks, I don't know about, right? I don't know about it because I haven't studied them. So that's why we need all kinds of different people in this community, because there are all kinds of masterworks I don't know about. And that is why we're all together, is we're all, you know, we're all explorers in the StoryGrid universe. And so we all need to help each other find new masterworks, because it's all going to enlighten us in ways that we can't even begin to imagine. So I know that was probably a shitty answer, but it's the best I can do right now.
All right, here's another one. Do you have a litmus test for distinguishing an action story from a thriller story? If not, are there any clues that would be indicative of one versus the other?
Yeah, I do. The litmus test is that action is all about the external motor actions of the story from scene to scene. It's what I call the on-the-ground movement of the story. So a thriller sort of takes that and it hones it. It shines like a different lens on the action story. So here we have the action story, and then we need to refine the external arena, the external domain, sorry. And the way the thriller does that is through bringing externality of threat from directly bear it right down on the protagonist. So the thriller is about, that moment when it becomes personal. So the external antagonist really has set in motion a series of events to sadistically take pleasure from the pain of the protagonist. So think about a story like Seven. Seven is about this psychopath, sadist, who has figured out how to torment and derive great pleasure from destroying the Brad Pitt character. So the choices that they made in Seven, I thought were really smart, because they created a fantastic world, right? So when you go back and watch the movie Seven, I actually worked on the adaptation of Seven into a novel, right? So I did the novelization with a writer together, and we were talking about this when we were creating it. And Seven, I kept wondering to myself, why did they put this into some fantastic otherworldly city without being specific? I mean, it's obviously Los Angeles, right? But it never rains in Los Angeles, so why is it raining all the time? And the reason why they did that was to create an otherworldly, fantastical universe, because the amount of trauma and the horrific grotesquerie of the story was way, way high, right? So if they kept a realistic place, it would be too much for the audience. If you remember the movie, it's just horrific. So they had to create a fantastical alternative world to put this story in. Although it looks extraordinarily realistic, it is an alternative universe that this happens. So the action in Seven proceeds like a traditional police procedural story. Oh my God, we got this killer. How are we going to catch him? Oh my God, what's he doing? I can't figure it out. Oh my gosh, he's mirroring the seven deadly sins. Wow, what an insight, incredible. And then the end game of the story is that all of this was created as a work of art, a very dark, nihilistic, horrific work of art to torment the Brad Pitt character so that Kevin Spacey could die in ecstasy. He wanted to die in ecstasy. And his ecstasy was defined by the sadistic pleasure of destroying the worldview and life of the Brad Pitt character. That's a thriller. So the thriller is all about very high levels of mendacity in a realistic environment. An action story is just about surviving. So an action story, I maintain, is the ground floor of every story. It's the on-the-ground action that proceeds from scene to scene to scene to scene, and it solves the first problem of existential existence. The first existential problem is, how do I survive? So every story has to have a grounded action component to it. So that's why we have these, like, human being against the environment, human being against society. These are the same things that we all go through, right? So if you're going through a story, you're navigating the world and you're trying to change an institution, say this is like a worldview maturation plot, the action is about how that protagonist is coming up against institutions that are holding them down, right? So you have this action component. So all of these genres, these liminal genres, these everything above action, which is your primal genre, and worldview, which is your transcendent genre, this is all your hierarchy of Maslow needs. And when you find the global genre that you want to focus on, then you have some lenses to put on your microscope and your telescope in order to focus on that one arena on the hierarchy. It's a little... I'm still fleshing this out, but I'm extraordinarily confident. This is sort of like an insight this is like a 30-year insight. It took me 30 freaking years. And the other day I had, the clouds parted and, you know, I don't know if I'm right, but it feels right. And the monomythic tradition, you know, that old saying about, it's some Greek guy said the hedgehog has many, answers and the fox has one good one, right? I don't know. I forget what the, somebody looks it up on Google and puts it in the chat. I'd appreciate it. I used to think, am I a hedgehog or am I a fox? Which one am I? Right? And it finally dawned on me, oh shit, you got to be both. You got to be both. You got to have a monomyth and you've got to have heuristics for context. So when we began today, we're talking about what's a good hedgehog strategy for today's contemporary world? Should I do this or not? And so you need a heuristic that says, what's the context? Is it a good time to do this kind of thing? Yeah, probably not. Oh, I'm going to be a hedgehog when it comes to this manuscript. That's cool. But the fox has one overarching. And the fox is all about Jung's individuation, which is the heroic journey writ large, which is about having the courage to go into the unknown and to challenge yourself, knowing very well you're going to fall into chaos. And it's going to be extraordinarily disorienting, painful, and you're going to blow up your worldview. And things aren't going to feel like they ever did before. But you have to have that heroic spirit. This is how we level up on our hierarchy of development. This is Piaget's like developmental process. Idiots back in the 40s and 50s used to think that once you became 21, all your development's over, right? And then a lot of people got their head together and like, oh, that seems kind of ridiculous. So the thriller is a hedgehoggy heuristic that laser focuses on mendacity of contemporary life featuring a sadistic antagonist against usually a skilled every person. Someone who has some skills, you know? Usually thrillers are about people who have some skills. Even these thrillers that are about sort of alcoholics who are seeing things and are not sure, there's this embedded sense that they know something interesting that should be explored. So that's how I distinguish thriller from action. Action is about, you know, whether or not you're going to get out of the cave without, you know, before the air runs out. Whereas thrillers, like somebody is sucking the air out of the cave and you don't know who it is and you better find out fast and you better have a showdown with that antagonist, because guess who that antagonist really is psychically? It's you. It's your shadow. Right? So Jung is like really smart person. And that idea of the shadow is all of us have the ability to be sadistic assholes. And sometimes it feels good when somebody else suffers. And we've got to put a check on that behavior. And that's what the thriller's about. It's exploring. It's always personal. That's why the protagonist and the antagonist are very similar creatures. So that's what I have to say about that.
All right. Question from Megan. Does every scene have its own hero's mini journey? If so, do the five commandments line up with it? For example, which commandment is the meet the goddess?
(Clears throat) Well, what I would say is that it's the micro, every single five commandment story event, be it a beat, a scene, a sequence, a blah, blah, blah. It's confronting and metabolizing complexity. So when I talk about fears, P-H-E-R-E's, that's what I'm talking about. So the heroic journey is the process by which we confront unexpected, uncertain, random shit that drops into our life and disturbs our worldview. I think I'm getting coffee, but there's a skateboard that I just stepped on that has knocked me on my ass. That is an unexpected event, random, that drops in. So now I have to change my worldview based upon that unexpected drop in. So we have these levels, right? We have these levels of our confrontation with unexpected events. And they progress, right? Progressively complicate until our very understanding of what's real fragments. That's the midpoint climax of a global story for the heroic journey, like for, you know, Wizard of Oz and Hobbit. You know, this stuff constantly occurs. I believe the midpoint of Wizard of Oz is when they get there and they think the wizard's going to solve all their problems. And he goes, you know what? I'm not doing shit for you until you bring back a dead witch. Go kill that bitch and then come back and we'll talk. It's a blow up of your fragment. Like, but there was certainty that if I just asked you nicely that you would give me what I wanted. Bang, there goes your framework. Now, those four clowns have to contemplate, do I want to kill the witch in order to get what I want? So that's a bitch, right? So that's what we're talking about. We have to build these little micro things where we have to confront unexpected events. So basically, the turning point progressive complication is the moment in that unit where the character or characters come to the realization, holy shit, the value just changed and I don't know why. I've sensed that they're about to punch me in the face and I don't know what I did. Oh my God, what am I going to do? And then you have to take that turning point progressive complication and make sense of what's going on. You have to examine the events that have preceded that moment, and you have to piece together sensical meaning, right? And the meaning culminates in a binary choice. It's either this or that. Best bad choice or irreconcilable good, right? There's nuance, right? You don't get, there's no certainty, and you're going to have to sacrifice, requires sacrifice. That's what we have to do in our lives. We have to understand that there is no certainty. There is no single ideology that's going to tell us what to do. We have agency. And when we subscribe to an ideology and say, here's my agency, then we are no longer sovereign. We no longer control our agency. And we start to do things because the ideology says we must. Well, what am I supposed to do here? Or let me check the handbook. Right? And this happens all over the place on multiple tribes. And it's a real danger. When you build a tribe, you've got to really confront this reality. So that's why I always say, I don't know everything. I'm just another lonely pilgrim on this planet. I'm in the universe with you. I've got some ideas. I've got some good places where we can hang out, but I don't know it all. So that's why I'm even like, I love the ideas that I'm coming up with, because they're not algorithms. The minute I start telling all of you what to do, and no, that's not right. The hero has to do this at this moment. Nope. Yeah, you just can't do it any other way. That's when you should start pulling your subscriptions, right? Because you all have agency. You all are sovereign human beings who are in the same space I am, who have subjective brilliance that I don't have. I'll never have it. But you do. You don't have what I have, and I don't have what you have. But guess what? We're all in this weird place together, and we can help each other. So that's the hero's journey, the individuation, the monomyth writ large. And yes, whoever asked that question, I forget your name, you're absolutely right. It's right in that, it's in every unit of story. Oh, right. That's why they did. Oh, right. So, but again, don't overthink this shit either. Just write it. And then if you go, hey, that feels good, it's right. So trust your brilliant story sense, because it's the force. Luke doesn't think about shit when he has to fire that missile. He turns off the computer because he's like, I got this. It's in me. And if it's not in me, at least I tried, right? I felt, you know, it feels right to do it this way. So that's the way you kind of have to feel. Like when you start getting heady in your head and saying, well, I'm not really sure which kind of genre this is or what that is. And just sort of like say, you know what, that scene just doesn't work. Or, you know what, it's pretty good. It's pretty good for now. I'm going to let it go. Okay.
All right. This one's from Maria. Are there any books by female authors in the pipeline for SG Publication?
No. So let's go, ladies. Let's go, women. Bring them on. We're desperate. We want them.
Yeah. I mean, we do on the nonfiction side. We have.
Plenty. Oh, sure. Yeah. All of them are.
all right.
But I do want to address the idea of, you know, sort of like the Sauron eye of, you know, judgment when you send in something. And we initially and still to this day wish that this emerges, but we can't top down make it happen. Okay, so what I mean by that is it's always been my idea that our editors become emergent sources of material. So editors, now this is another thing that is extraordinarily difficult that nobody has really named or labeled, but it's extraordinarily difficult to put your name on something. Right? There's an old joke in Hollywood where these two agents went to lunch at the same agency. And the one agent said to the other, did you read that new screenplay? What do you think? And the other agent says, yeah, I read it over the weekend, but I don't know what I think yet because I'm the only one who's read it. And that's a problem, because we all fear saying this is a great work of art because other people are going to say, you know, this book really needed an editor. And I find all of those reviews of every book I've ever edited, and I want to find that person who wrote that review and kill them. But I don't. But that's a difficult thing. So anyway, emergently, all of our editors have the capability and they have the power and they are have the agency to say and bring a book that they've worked on with someone and say, you know what? I'm going to die on this cross. I want to publish this book and here's why. Right? And guess what's going to happen? We're probably going to publish it, even if I don't think it works. Why? Because I don't know everything. And neither does Tim. You've got two guys who are doing our best. We don't know everything. We're giving it the best shot. We're flying blind. So we need emergent editors to rise and say, you know what? This works. I put my name on it. My name's going on the front cover. I'm going to bust my ass. I'm going to do everything possible to make it the best story it can be, but we should publish it. And we're going to publish those books. So when you're submitting, think about aligning with an editor. You know, think about that, because that's a way that we can diversify our offerings to the world. Right now, it's Tim and I reading submissions and, you know, me being Mr. Publisher and going, well, that market, I'm not sure about that market right now. And sometimes you have to publish into markets that I'm just not that familiar with. And we need you editors out there to step up. You know what? What happens is it's like anything else. Once you put your name on something and it goes out into the world, and you suffer the indignity of people writing reviews saying that this really just needed an editor and it could have been a good book, you get over it and you keep doing it and you get better and you get better and you start building relationships with writers. And the next thing you know, that bothers you for a microsecond and then you laugh about it and move on with your life. So we want not just women, we want all genres, all stories, everything. We want it all. We want it all. I didn't get into this to do one genre or one kind of book. I want it all. All or nothing for me. And all includes, guess what? Everyone. All stories. All things. So get to it. I can't do it for you. There's no top-downing this. I'm not going to assign editors, go find me a novel in this category and you've got 3 weeks. No, not going to do it. I'd love to do that. Would solve a lot of problems, but that's bullshit and I'm not going to do it. You have to seize the day, seize your agency, editors, and do this yourselves. And we are here. It's a garden, not a trap. There's no trap here. It's a garden. We're going to try it. We're going to try it. And everybody in this guild is supporting that. So think about all these people in this guild. They are the ones who are supporting this garden. They're the one watering it every day. All of you show up. You all show up. You're all watering the garden. You're all doing your work. You're all thinking through this stuff. And you're all leveling up micro every single day. I swear to God, it's true. So keep doing it. And what emerges is more and more good stuff. And when somebody puts garbage in the garden, everybody goes, hey, shit, you know, get that garbage out of here. We don't want it. And that's how we keep everything cool and good and emergent. And all that stuff. So bring on the books. Bring them all on. Okay.
That's it. All right. Well, we'll stop there. And I would be remiss here to remind everybody that we do have an editor training coming up in September. I sent out an email a couple days ago And if you're thinking about it, there are several in the guild that are coming to the next training. And of course, all the past editors, whenever people ask me about it, I just encourage them to talk to existing editors, because of course I'm going to try to talk you into it, but, you know, talk to somebody who's gone through the process and has been a part of it now. And then we've had several messages both, today and then on the Tuesday call when I came on, just wanting to thank you for spearheading the sprints for the last 14, 15 weeks and doing the scene analysis and showing up for the Q&A, and everybody's just really appreciated it, Sean.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Yes. It's been my pleasure. I mean, this is what keeps me sane. So I wish I could say it was really painful, but I love doing this stuff. What I would encourage everyone to do is, if you have five friends, two friends, one friend from the guild, and you want to continue these, I can't recommend this more. Just do what I'm doing. It's not rocket science. Look at a scene that you love and go, if someone asked me what kind of scene this was, what would I say? And then you categorize it for whatever it is that is, right? And then you say, well, let me walk through these processes to analyze it, and do that, and find a friend and say, hey, let's get together for a half an hour on Wednesdays, and every other week we'll each take a scene. And guess what happens? 52 weeks, you've got 52 examples of scenes that you and your friend or friends love that you can all start referring to. So when you get stuck and you go, I don't know what to do about this turning point progressive complication in my second act, someone would go, what have you thought about that meet the parents scene from In the Dream House? Because that one really was cool, right? So she foreshadowed all that stuff about this, her lover beating her in the future in that one scene, and it's all about her drunk father. That was awesome. Like, try that. And you can do that over and over and over again. And guess what? In the guild, I encourage everyone to drop that into the ecosystem so that everybody has like thousands of scenes that have been analyzed and thought through, categorized in the meet the parents trope. Here's the blah, blah, blah trope. And anyway, so keep it going. You don't need me to do this. You really don't. I'm trying to figure out the DNA of metaphysics, so I'll let you know when I figure that out, and then we'll take it from there. But yeah, and editors, you know, I hope everyone can come to this next thing, because it's going to be pretty cool. All right, that's it.
All right, we'll wrap it there. Yeah, and for those of you that weren't on the call on I think it was Tuesday, all my days are run together. There are people already organizing to keep sprints going. So all of that's happening in the forum. So if you've missed that, just go back and check in there. Thanks to Valerie and Allison and Renee who kept these going, because if it was requiring me or Sean to show up at the same time every day, it wouldn't have happened. So thank you to you three for keeping this going. And we're going to go, I mean, obviously just the sprints are ending, all the other guild stuff is going to continue. So we're excited about that. And yeah, we'll see you down the road. Thanks, everybody.
Okay. Bye, everybody.